This is Stellacast, episode 12. Hello and welcome to another episode of Stellacast. My name is Jacob Burton. Stellacast found online at stellaculinary.com. And, you know, we're here with this episode. We're going to talk about some of the things that have been going on the Stella Culinary Forum. And with me to help out on that end, we have Mucho Bocho, who is a Stella Culinary member and a real OG when it comes to cooking. What's up, Mucho?
Hi, everybody.
Good to have you. And he's joining us on Skype. We're still kind of figuring some things out, so you know, if it sounds kind of blown out on your end, we do apologize. We're just going to try and get you some good answers and go from there. Right, Mucho?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Hey, so, I mean, you're always into something as far as, you know, when we're talking on the forums, it looks like you're working on all sorts of things, whether it's a charcuterie project, you're doing brisket. What have you been into lately that's really been exciting you?
Let's see. I am always into something. It seems like with each season, there's some new ingredient to play with, or you kind of get tired of working on the same ingredients, so you're kind of off doing other things. I have recently, you may have seen, purchased a tomato-type cooker. It's a style that looks like a large egg. In fact, there's a brand that is named that, and I've been messing with that quite a bit. It's good to kind of keep the heat outdoors in the summertime, especially down here in Carolina. And so, I've been doing some different things with it.
A lot of people, they probably know the big brand, which is the Big Green Egg, but it's just those cookers that you see, those barbecues that are shaped like the egg, like you said. Now, what have you found with those style of cookers, the egg style cookers that are over your, you know, your normal kettle style coal grill or even your gas grill? What makes them preferential to you?
So this style of cooking is very unique. There is, unlike any other type of barbecue setup, offset smoker, kettle type grills, what makes this unit so effective is that it has it creates a very slow convection inside. And as a result, you can barbecue at very low, stable temperatures, unattended, for hours on end with a small amount of charcoal and have a very stable temperature at which to cook for long cooks. It's also effective at cooking very high cooks. You can cook. I've done some pizzas recently and been working in the temperatures of 700 degrees and above.
Oh wow! How have those been coming out?
They're great. The Jacob, thank you for improving my dough recipe that I've been using for years. Some of the details, especially the oilized, which I've never done before, really made a difference in the texture, especially. And they're great. They cook very quickly. Nice thing is again, you get a nice, consistent, stable temperature. And I actually had retrofit a carbon steel plate to sit inside the grill to give me what professionals call a plancha, or you might call at home a griddle. And I cooked the pizzas on that.
Now, you're using double aught flour then for those high temp cooks? You're doing something along the lines of like a Neapolitan style pizza dough?
It is, yeah. That's the style that I like. It's the style that I made when I lived in New England, from Southside in Plymouth, Mass. And I grew up in a pizzeria there, and that was the style that that we cooked. Certainly, lots of other styles are great, too. I prefer a nice, dense crust that's got good chew, texture, got that smokiness from the baking stone, cooks very quickly, and can be put with lots of different ingredients.
Yeah, I like to say that I'm a non-denominational pizza lover, you know, because you get into all these battles of, you know, Chicago not being a real pizza, Neapolitan, and then California being like the bastard child of all pizzas. But for me, I think any style of pizza executed correctly is delicious. I mean, it's, you know, fresh baked bread with toppings. I mean, what's not to like? But with that said, I mean, for definitely the hardest style to recreate is definitely the Neapolitan. Everything from just being able to, you know, draw out that long fermentation and make the dough workable, all the way up to being able to, you know, get a temperature hot enough to bake in your we have the wood fire oven in the Stella restaurant. But, you know, when you try and do with the baking steel and the broiler set up at home, you know, in 500 degrees, it still never fully recreates that leoparding or that char on the crust. Mm-hmm. And I really want to get a Big Green Egg or a Komodo style cooker like that you're using to play around with that fundamentally, because, you know, it's difficult to recreate in the home oven or just the home kitchen in general, unless you have a barbecue grill that can get really, really high temperatures like you're talking about, or if you're lucky enough to have a wood fire oven in your backyard.
No, you're absolutely correct. And I actually have a carbon steel sheet quarter inch that I had made for my oven. And I would heat that up. I have a decent Kenmore setup, nothing too fancy. And it would take about a half hour, 40 minutes. I could get the surface to close to 600 degrees, and found that was also an effective way to do it. But I truly think that cooking Neapolitan with some kind of live fire setup is the secret.
Yeah, the live fire is really important. You know, you have when you're doing it traditionally in the wood fire, you have the wood banked to, you know, one of the sides, and you have that flame that licks up over the top, and then we'll do the doming step at the end where, I mean, a true Neapolitan pizza should cook under 90 seconds. So we'll have our deck at about 850 degrees Fahrenheit. The dome is over 1,000. So, you know, at about the 50-second mark, that pizza is pretty much done on the bottom, and the crust on the top is pretty much damn near perfect. And we'll just pick it up and hold it to the dome for about 3 seconds. And it gives you that beautiful char, almost that broiler-style effect, but it's so hot.
That's
and
awesome.
I mean, there's certain things that you just, I mean, there's flavors that you can't recreate. The leoparding is really tough to recreate. And, you know, one of my favorite Neapolitan pizzas, which is very unclassic, is we'll just do some spinach with goat cheese. And the goat cheese turns into almost like molten lava. And the spinach we put on raw, and you put on a big handful, and it just chars and condenses down in 50 seconds. So you get this really, really intense spinach flavor that if you were just to put raw spinach on like a New York-style pizza crust and bake in your oven at 500 degrees, you would just never be able to recreate that same intensity of flavor.
I actually did a style of that this week, only I used the broccoli raw.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
You know, and that just has that kind of, you blanch it quick.
Mm-hmm.
Cut it up into small individual pieces, you know, get as much moisture as you can. One thing I was messing around with too, we were talking in the past about using chamber vacs and vacuum pack sealers and stuff for different uses. I find that what I'll do is I'll take my fresh mozzarella, slice it, lay it out on paper towels, and put that in a vac bag, and then hit it one cycle. And it just pulls so much of the moisture from inside the mozzarella, makes it that much drier, and you know, to get you that creamy, crusty kind of, you know, charred flavor. Quicker.
Yeah, you know, that's a great idea. I've never thought of doing that, because when we do the classic, just margherita pizza, Neapolitan style, we're using the fresh mozzarella, buffalo mozzarella, if we can get it. But you do always have those issues with the moisture content, especially when you're cooking it as hot and as fast as you do in a wood fire oven. You know, you can have all sorts of issues. So pulling the moisture out with a chamber vac bag, that's a great idea. I'm going to have to give that one a shot. And you're just sandwiching it in between like some paper towels?
And actually, it works great for eggplant as well, because you kind of have that same issue with, you know, kind of letting the eggplant weep a little bit.
Yeah. Are you salting it first?
Yep.
Yeah. And are you salting it and then letting it sit, or are you just putting it directly into the chamber?
I do. I'll salt it, basically cut it up, salt it, and then clean my surface area, kind of give it a few seconds for the salt to just dissolve a little bit and so that it's not hard anymore. Mm-hmm. And then, you do want some moisture to accumulate. When you look at the surface of the eggplant, it will go from a very clear moisture, almost looking like dew, to almost a browny kind of, have a little bit more color when it's pulled out some of that bitterness from the eggplant. That's when you want to hit it. But don't hit it too hard because, as you know, you'll completely rupture all the texture.
What are you using? What chamber vacuum sealer are you using?
I use the VacMaster VP112.
Okay.
So it's that kind of consumer targeted model that will pull 28 millimeters of mercury. So we'll pull a full vacuum. If I was going to do the eggplant, I'd probably do the eggplant somewhere around maybe 25 seconds.
Okay. How do you like the VP112?
I'm not going to say that it's been completely bulletproof, but mm-hmm. for bringing a product like that at that price point to the market, I was kind of an earlier adopter to it. And I've gone through a few different lenses. It's the kind of the top to them. I did have to send it back one time for some other parts that need to be replaced. I'll say their customer service is excellent. They're very accessible in terms of getting to them. They took care and they upgraded my unit without any cost. I would recommend the unit. Mm-hmm. And I'd say I've had it 4 years and I've probably done 5,000 bags.
Wow. Yeah, we have the VP215, which is has the oil motor. And, that thing's been a workhorse for us, and it's kind of it's not really meant for the professional kitchen, but it's big enough for us to where it gets the job done. And, it's just been absolutely great so far. Those are your kids in the background?
We got the kiddos coming in.
Oh, no problem. Yeah. Hey, guys.
Talk to them.
What's going on?
Say hi. We're doing this live, so say hi.
Who is it?
Hey,
he's my friend. It's a chef. Helps me cook.
Okay,
you guys can go. Sorry, I'm back.
Yeah, the VacMaster for us has worked well, and for $800, we've beaten the hell out of it, and we've gotten about four years of good use. So that's interesting, though. It's we're always finding uses like that as well with what you're doing with the eggplant. One of the things that we've been doing a lot for over the last year is, we've been playing with our own ramen noodles. And with ramen, you have to have that really low hydration. And we found the best way to actually hydrate it, especially since it's not a yeasted dough, is we run it through a cycle in a vac bag. And it hydrates almost instantly. And it's great for that resting period during hydration.
Yeah, no, it's an incredibly useful device. I think people associate it with traditionally food storage. Mm-hmm. And when you do step into the chamber and you start to mess around with different attachments. So mine has a really interesting attachment that I can use to vacuum ball jars.
Yeah, that's cool. We don't have that attachment, and I wish we did.
Yeah, that has been phenomenally helpful, especially, Jacob, when creating marinades and or even salad dressings where it will – you can pull a full vacuum on it, and what would take maybe a day to diffuse those flavors traditionally to give you that sort of more cohesive flavor of salad dressing, you can achieve really within one cycle.
You know, I've seen some people too where they do in the jars, they'll make almost like a makeshift sorbet. They'll whip some air into the sorbet mix or into the fruit mix, and then they pull a vacuum on it and they stop it in the sealed jar. So now you have air incorporated into the liquid in the jar, and they just pop it in the freezer and they freeze it. And there, you can get some pretty cool textures that way. Doing it with whipped cream or sorbet.
You know what's really nice too? Would probably work great for a restaurant, mm-hmm. especially if you want to preserve texture in foods. So, say, Alaskan crab legs, you kind of remove the crab.
Yeah.
You know, you want to warm that. Sure, you could do it in butter, but you don't really want to cook it anymore, but you do want to warm it. I'll put that in a vessel that you can lay them into. So, say, like an earthenware vessel, so it has sides to it. And then you run a vac just enough so that the bag is pressing on the crab, but it's not compressing the crab in the dish.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pop that into the water bath.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And total ease of execution, too, which we're always looking for. I mean, there's so many things that we'll chamber vacuum seal and then retherm in the water bath for, you know, using the immersion circulator, just because it's so simple and foolproof. And, you know, when it comes to doing it on a professional level, I mean, execution and consistency is always key. But, you know, I just got done doing a boot camp last week, and I preach the same thing at every boot camp, where it's like, you know, you people are spending a lot of money to be here at this boot camp. I know you guys have well-stocked kitchens. I mean, they show up with $300-$400 chef's knife, and I'm still correcting their grip sometimes. And it's like, you know, and then they, you know, and then they're like, oh, well, an immersion circulator and chamber vacuum. So you're like, that's not very realistic for the home. I'm like, it's one of the most realistic things ever. You know, I mean, they'll show me pictures of their beautiful kitchens with their custom Wolf ranges and you know, copper pots hanging from their center island. And it's like, wow, for the cost of like two copper pots, you could have a chamber vacuum sealer and an immersion circulator, and it'll give you such a massive advantage over other home cooks that don't have it, just from an ease of execution standpoint, really.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, we could talk on the sous vide subject, you know, for hours. You know, it leads me to kind of something that isn't talked about a whole lot, but I found so utterly practical in the kitchen. And that is, you know, we spend a lot of money buying pots and pans that, you know, maybe collections or not, but in some way they go together as a kit.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it comes to plastics, you know, houses are filled with things they get at restaurants or, you know, things that were on sale at the grocery store, as opposed to upfront simply investing in some useful pieces of Cambro.
Yeah.
That they can use time and time again for multiple uses, you know, the safety levels, I mean, these things are workhorses, as you know, and if you think of them more like pots and pans, less like disposable items, I think that that's something I've really found very useful in my kitchen.
Yeah, and what Muccio's talking about is the Cambro storage containers, which they're just high-grade food plastic or high-grade plastic that you can use for food storage. And that's what you'll see, the square containers and the round containers that are used in restaurant kitchens, if you've ever seen that. But you can find them online. You can get them on Amazon. And they're bulletproof, and they're great for storing things. I have those at home instead of the regular Tupperware containers. Because the Tupperware containers, they, you know, they deform and they break, and, you know, they get trashed real easily. And, you know, so instead of buying Tupperware once a year, go to your restaurant supply store or go to Amazon.com and, you know, search Cambros and just buy some smaller Cambros. And especially if you're making stocks, or even you'll watch like my bread videos, you'll see me proofing things in plastic containers. You know, all those are Cambros, and I love them because they're tall and they're square. So the footprint that they take up on your kitchen counter or in your refrigerator really, you know, is minimal. You look at, you know, I go to my mom's house and she's, you know, making something and she's trying to store it in her fridge. She pulls out the big round Pyrex bowl, and that Pyrex bowl takes up a massive footprint in the kitchen or in the fridge.
Yeah. And what's interesting too is when you do collect a few of those different Cambro containers, some you might want for mise en place or for small prep, but they're the absolute best thing to sous vide in. And
yeah.
I think that a lot of cooks that do sous vide, at least in my experience, use oftentimes too large a vessel for what they're sous videing. You know, we think of these things as like large coolers, or you know, you see the 2 gallon containers that folks use quite a bit. But you can effectively sous vide or even rethermal meat. So when I do the chicken wings that we sous vide for 4 hours at 140 degrees, I'm sous videing that in an 8-quart Cambro.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you just need enough water to submerge, you know. How are those wings turning out for you at 140?
Great. Yeah. Great. I'll tell you, I've messed with, I like 140 in general for a temperature. Mm-hmm. I have messed around with the times a little bit.
Yeah.
And in terms of, I've gone 2 hours, I've gone 4 hours, and I'll be honest, one night I forgot it in the garage, and I ran it 24 hours. And there was definitely less moisture, a lot more rendering of fat in the 24-hour cook, which I probably wouldn't recommend.
Right.
But the beautiful thing about sous vide is you generally do have such a wide window of which food is done that as long as you do hit that, if you're going for fully cooked by the time you take it out of the sous vide bath, you can pretty much hold it at that temperature for quite a lot of time.
Yeah, and we found that in our testing, and this is just us being dorks and getting together and really splitting hairs. But you know what we found is with the smaller wings, if you go past 2 hours, and we always try and start with jumbo wings for our test, but in the case of a smaller chicken wing, if you go past 2 hours, you will notice less moisture. But also, too, it's a trade-off for crisper skin because you have more rendering. So even during the jumbo wings, when we did a side-by-side taste test, when you're splitting hairs, you know, the 2 hour is very slightly more moist than the 4 hours, but the 4 hours for us still won out because it was still moist enough and the skin got much crispier because it had a longer time to render and to break down the collagen in the skin. But yeah, I mean, we've been real happy with the 140 degrees for 4 hours temperature.
Yeah, I agree. I like the fact that you don't have to dry brine them before, which is a fine method as well. I know mm-hmm. we've been talking about that on the forum a little bit, and it is what I did before. You know, I was turned on to sous vide, but for me, the beauty of sous vide is that you know once you cook it and you cool it properly. You know,
all right. Well, Dan, it looks like we lost mucho bocho, but you know we'll go ahead and pick up this conversation back over on the forums. He was finishing his thoughts on chicken wings, dry brining, and sous vide. But the consensus that seems to be emerging with all the tests that myself and Ben and Alex and the other members on the forum have been doing is that sous vide chicken wings at 140 degrees Fahrenheit for 4 hours as you pre-cook is working pretty good. And because it retains so much moisture, dry brining, which is a very common step where you're just dry salting the wings and letting them hang out, isn't really that necessary. So anyways, hey, I apologize for the technical difficulties. I think it's actually something on my end, unfortunately. But I'm going to look into that, and I really want to thank Mucho again for coming on and hanging out with us. Guy is just a wealth of information, and you know, he brings a lot to the table in the sense that he doesn't cook professionally, but he is a very avid home cook. So, you know, he has a lot of the tools that we would use in the professional kitchen, and you know, as you can see with his chamber vacuum sealer tips, talking about you know, his eggplant and how he's drawing excess moisture out of the eggplant or drawing excess moisture out of the mozzarella. I mean, really, really good tips. So head on over to this episode's show notes. You can find them at stellacolony.com/scast12. And that'll drop you into this episode's show notes. We'll put links to some of the forum threads that we were discussing and links to also the technology and the tools that we were discussing. And thanks so much for listening. Hey, real quick before we go, thank you once again for joining us for this episode of Stella Cast. If you enjoy these episodes, head on over to iTunes or Stitcher. Search for Stella Cast and you can subscribe there to make sure that you don't miss any upcoming episodes. And we do have some fun ones planned for you. We will be doing some more interview-based episodes, answering some forum topic questions, and having some great culinary discussions. You can find all of the StellaCast episodes by going to stellaculinary.com/StellaCast. Thank you again for listening, and we will see you in the next episode.